The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Well, good morning. This is WTBR's Morning Drive, and I'm your guest host this morning, Brian Burkle. We are live and local at our WTBR studio on Federico Drive, and today is Thursday, April 18th. So welcome to the show. We have a special guest in studio today. It's Ed Newmyth, who is a active birder. He's going to talk to us today about birding here in the Berkshires. Hi, Ed.
How you doing, Brian?
Good, good. So before we get started, we are going to check in with the National Weather Service. I think everybody can look outside and by themselves say, yuck. But well, let's see what they have to say from the professionals.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, showers this morning, then a chance of showers and drizzle this afternoon. Cooler, near steady temperature in the mid-40s. East wind 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour. Chance of rain 90%. Tonight, a chance of showers in the evening. Mostly cloudy with a chance of drizzle. Lows around 40. East wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 30%. Friday, mostly cloudy. Highs in the upper 50s. Southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour in the afternoon. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, kind of what we expect for April, right? So, Ed, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian.
Yeah, so for everybody out there listening, I want to introduce you to Ed Newmyth. Ed is an active birder. He's a retired veterinarian. He's an active birder in the Berkshires since 1974, and we did the quick math on that. It's 50 years, so I think he knows what he's talking about. He's also the past president for the Hoffman Bird Club. He ran a breeding bird survey for the government for a number of years. He's led field trips for the Mass Audubon and for the trustees, and he was a birder instructor for the OLLI program here. And I know Ed because we worked together and down at Canyon Ranch doing the hikes, and Ed is always full of knowledge when it comes to the information he can share with our guests about the birds here in the Berkshire. So really glad to have you here, Ed, because this is birding season coming up, right?
This is, Brian.
Yep. So if somebody's going to be getting into birding, right, here in the Berkshires or anywhere for that matter, one of the tools of the trade, of course, are binoculars, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So if someone's considering buying binoculars, because I know that there's different binoculars with different abilities and so forth. So what is somebody looking for if they're going to get binoculars for this purpose?
So some of the features, Brian, that are important enough to mention, there are many different brands, but if you look at the binoculars, you'll see that there are differences in power. That is to say, there'll be like 7x35, which is, we call it 7x35. Mm-hmm. So the first number in that is the magnification or the power. So I should mention that birding binoculars really should be between 7 and 10 power. If you get, so most people that I take on the Canyon Ranch birding event that aren't familiar with binoculars will say, well, gee, I'd like to get to 10 power because mm-hmm. they're going to make things bigger. Well, you have to consider the field of view because mm-hmm. 7 power is going to give you a much bigger field of view, mm-hmm. so it's a lot easier to find the birds. Mm-hmm. There are some other features. So field of view is important. And I should mention at this point that sometimes people get compact binoculars, which are great for hiking. They're really light, but they don't have the light gathering capacity, which we'll talk about in just a second.
Yeah, sure.
So the field of view is important. So 7 to 10 power is what we're looking for in binoculars for birding. There are eye cups, which if you're wearing glasses, you turn the eye cups in. If you're not wearing glasses, you turn the eye cups out. So there are two different kinds of eye cups. There are twisting eye cups, and there are rubber eye cups that you flip out. Mm-hmm. I would prefer, if you're buying binoculars, that you look for the twist-out eye cups, because if you use the rubber eye cups frequently, eventually the rubber deteriorates, and one of these days you'll flip out the eye cup and you'll have the rubber in your hand. So that's part of the eye cup thing that's, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. So the other item is light gathering, which is the amount of light that passes through the binocular into your eyes. So the easiest way to determine light gathering is to take the second number. Let's use 7 by 35 as an example. Mm-hmm. You take the second number, 35, which is technically the I don't want to get into it because it's not terribly important, but what it is if you divide the first number into the second number, you get the light gathering value, which in this case is 5, mm-hmm. 7 by 35, which is the standard kind of beginning binocular, 7 power giving you a wide field of view, and the 35 divided in by the 7 mm-hmm. will give you the 5 light gathering. So you want at least between 3.5 and 5 plus light gathering units to make your make the colors appear in the birds. I remember once I was doing a field trip at Notch View, and there was a bluebird on a nest box, and I said, "Oh, look at that bluebird!" And one of the women there who had compact binoculars said, "How do you know it's a bluebird?" I said, "Well, look at it. It's got a blue back and, you know, kind of a reddish belly." She said, "Really?" And I said, "Try these binoculars." And I gave her mine, and she said, "Oh, my God, it looks just like the field guide." So
And because obviously the colors, I mean, that's a big part of being able to identify these birds.
And also the fact that if you're going to be a birder, you're probably going to be getting up early in the morning to go out. Mm. And that's when birds are most active, and so there's less light at that point. So you're going to have the better light gathering.
Right.
So
who knew there was so much math involved with birding?
Yeah, there's well, it's pretty simple if you figure it out.
Yeah.
But it's just the light gathering is important, and so another adjustment that you should be looking for is usually on the right eyepiece, there's an adjustment that will allow for the differences between your two eyes. So I should mention that as you age, your eyes age independently of one another. Hmm. Now, if you're wearing glasses, hopefully your glasses prescription will accommodate the difference. But if you're not wearing glasses, there is an adjustment on the right eyepiece that will allow you to make the adjustment to correct the difference in your two eyes. Mm-hmm. I won't get into how you do that. That's usually in the instructions of the binoculars, but it is important.
Yeah. So that's the main tool that we need.
Pretty much,
birding, right? So there's a lot to know there about getting the proper equipment, because you don't want to go out without the right tools.
Right, and so the other piece of equipment is a spotting scope, which is considerably more expensive. So binocular costs range for somewhat quality binoculars somewhere between like $135 and $2,500, which you want to stay away from.
Yeah.
So another feature that is variable on binoculars is what's called armor coating or rubber coating on the outside. Mm-hmm. This is in case you drop the binoculars, you don't put them out of alignment.
Right.
That's an option. Not every pair of binoculars has it. And if you're careful with your binoculars, as you should be, you probably don't need it, quite honestly.
Right.
But the scopes are particularly beneficial for things like waterfowl, seabird watching, and shorebirds, because they magnify up to well, between like 35 and 60 power.
Mm-hmm.
So that's far more than your binoculars. Mm. And this is for long distance birding. But you can do just completely fine with just a good set of binoculars. So I should mention also, there's a lot of birding paraphernalia that you can buy. Like anything else, once it becomes popular, there's all kinds of gadgets that you can buy. Save your money for good binoculars.
Okay.
They are the ticket for good birding.
All right.
So
kind of look past all that extra stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, a lot of it is completely unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
What you need to go birding is a pair of binoculars, a field guide, a notebook, and a pencil.
Okay.
That's it. You don't need all the fancy equipment.
So let's talk a little bit about birding here in the Berkshires. Again, just what anybody just joining us here on the morning drive, we have in studio today Ed Newmuth, who is I call him a birding expert. He says, don't say that word. But he certainly knows a lot about birds. And I've been on a number of walks with him where he is very knowledgeable. He's got a lot of experience, been birding here in the Berkshires for about 50 years. So Ed, I want to ask you a little bit more about the Berkshires itself and why the Berkshires is so good for birding and what's happening right now here in the Berkshires.
Okay, so this is, I'll use an analogy. You remember when you were a youngster, the day before your birthday,
mm-hmm.
you got really excited because the best was yet to come, but it was all good.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening in the Berkshires right now. We're in the throes of bird migration, so that a lot of the birds that have wintered over south of us are now in the process of moving into the Berkshires. Some of them will nest. Some of them will move through and nest up in Canada. But this is the exciting time for birders. So if you go out and you take a walk every day on the same property, it's likely, very likely, that between now and probably May 15th, you will see a different species of bird every day.
Mm.
So this is it's a terribly exciting time for birding. So I should mention migrants, just because this is migration. I consider migrants as like two different kinds of migrants. There are what I call or refer to as weather migrants, which are birds that have wintered over in southern United States or along the coast where there's food, water, and shelter. They're the first to arrive,
mm-hmm.
and those include things like some of the early warblers, like yellow rump warblers. They're
mm-hmm.
here now. A lot of the sparrows. But then there are another whole set of migrants that are neotropical, and they are more inclined to be coming up here because of daylight change.
Mm, okay.
So they're the later migrants, but they're incredibly predictable. So if you go out and you have a big field near your property and you go out and you look for a bobolink, which winters over in the Pampas in Argentina and the Llanos in Brazil, you'll see that the arrival date, the first bobolink that you see at that field near your neighborhood will come within a couple of days of each other.
Mm.
Whereas some of these sparrows are much more likely to be, well, they're weather migrants. So
mm-hmm.
so weather is going to push them back or hold them, and right. then they'll be arriving, after the weather.
Because weather can be variable, whereas the others are.
Weather can be extremely variable.
Yeah, and the others are on they're following the light.
Yeah,
and the light doesn't change. The light's going to be the same every year.
That's going to be
right.
the same.
Got it.
So their arrival times are much more predictable. But they can still be held up a little bit by weather. Let's say in New Jersey, there's some
mm-hmm.
foul weather that might delay them 1 or 2 days.
Well,
but you're going to find that the arrival dates on the neotropical migrants is much, much more predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's migration. So I should mention also that there's a word that you'll come up with if you're talking about migration or reading about migration. It's called Zugenruh.
Zugenruh?
Zugenruh. It's a German word that Zug is the word for tug. Mm-hmm. Unruh is unrest. So it's the quality of, I can't even describe this because we don't have it anymore as humans, but it's the urge to migrate. Mm. So example, you might be down on the shore looking at a flock of shorebirds that are feeding. There's plenty of food around. The weather is perfectly comfortable for them to stay, but there's an unrest. Mm. They know that they need to move. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we've lost that.
So it's something physiologically that just
motivates them. It's a physiological urge for them to get up and go, mm-hmm. even though conditions may be favorable. Mm-hmm. So that drives migration in some of these birds. And certainly Zugenruh is important for some of these birds. Yeah. That the light depends... the dependence on light change, mm-hmm. is one of the things that makes them move, but also Zugenruh, mm-hmm. that urge to migrate, mm-hmm. which is something, yeah. like I said, we've lost, but
we have Farfugnugen, right?
What's that?
Farfugnugen, remember that?
Yeah.
From the car commercials.
That's the Volkswagen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the comfort of driving a Volkswagen.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So as far as the Berkshires go with this migration, what are we seeing right now, and how's this working out?
Okay, so the early migrants are arriving every day. Like I said, we'll get into the nesting season, which follows migration, obviously. So I should mention also that nesting season in the Berkshires, what makes it so exciting is that we have so many different habitats. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk a little bit about habitat because it's extremely important. Mm-hmm. We have elevation. We have Canada's own forests, which are forests that are balsam fir and spruce, mm-hmm. which they... So I should mention also that migration is great if you live on the coast, but quite honestly, birding in the nesting season is boring on the coast. Mm-hmm. It's all about the Berkshires.
Right.
So I have friends from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology that come out here and do a big day every year, mm-hmm. which is, we'll get into a little bit in a bit about what a big day is, mm-hmm. but they come and stay with me, and they start in the Berkshires because it's so rich. Mm-hmm. So we have the wetlands, we have the grasslands, we have the elevation, we have deciduous forest, we have Canada's own forest, we have it all.
Mm-hmm. So when you say that it's a little bit more exciting here in the Berkshires versus on the shore, is it because, like you said, of all the different habitat, so is it a little bit harder to find them, so it makes it a little bit more of a sport to locate them? Is that kind of what you're saying?
It's more like we just have the variety of habitats here, mm-hmm. that they don't have on the coast.
So just variety. That's what makes it.
It's the habitats, yeah. So habitat is incredibly important during the nesting season. Mm-hmm. In the migration, it's not so important. For instance, technically you could see a savanna sparrow in the forest, mm-hmm. During migration if there's food, water, and shelter there. But during the nesting season, you're not going to find a savanna sparrow in the forest. They're a grassland bird. Mm-hmm. So if you want to see a savanna sparrow, you have to know the habitat that to find it in during the nesting season. Mm-hmm. And that is, like I said, probably the most important thing in reference to a big day, mm-hmm. which you have the strategy of planning out.
So when you say a big day, is there one day that's designated for all birders, or is it that you make your own big day?
You make your own big day, but in the Berkshires, the best day would be, I would say, somewhere in the third week in May. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that you're going to see some birds that have overwintered that are still straggling here before they've leave to the breeding ground. Mm-hmm. You're going to see some neotropical migrants that are moving in. Mm-hmm. You're also going to see some birds that you're only going to see once or twice a year, which is on their way north to breed and on their way back to their wintering grounds. Mm-hmm. So these are things like Cape May warblers, Tennessee warblers, Blackburnian or bay-breasted warblers that nest north of us. Mm-hmm. The only time you're going to see them is when they're moving through the Berkshires to head north.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah? That's the only time?
Yeah. Or in the dull plumage.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit about molting and plumage in just a minute. But mm-hmm. How are we doing?
Doing great.
Okay.
Yeah, you're doing great.
All right. So, so the third week in May mm-hmm. is when you would plan a big day. And a big day is that 24 hours. You start at midnight and you go 24 hours. It's exhausting, but it's fun. And I do it every year in the town of Washington where mm-hmm. I live. Mm-hmm. Some people do it for the state. Some people do it for their yard, whatever. Mm-hmm. You make your own rules. Mm-hmm. That's the fun about birding.
So that 24-hour time frame, though, is that also up for, personal decisions, or is it
no,
set as
it's pretty much
midnight?
A big day is a okay. big day.
Okay.
It's one day. Mm-hmm. And then there are some people who do a big year where they'll take... This is a little bit more, number one, expensive, and number two, exhausting. Mm-hmm. They'll take a year and try to, like I'm reading a book right now by Noah Stryker, mm-hmm. who did a world big year. He spent, in 2015, I think it was, he spent an entire year birding all around the world to see, and he got like 6,000 species of birds plus. So exhausting, but that's the fun of birding. So,
is there any place in particular, like you said, you can kind of choose your own venue or your own area to do this big day or right. any birding for that matter, but are there places in Berkshire County that you recommend for people?
Well, I would say the most important thing about a big day is the strategy. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you sit down with the team that you're going to go out with, whether it's just you or whether it's a couple of people, whatever, mm-hmm. and you plan, okay, where are we going to find a white-breasted nuthatch? Where are we going to find a pied-billed grebe? And so you have the the species list that you're hoping to find mm-hmm. and the number one spot where you're likely to find it, and then a backup spot that mm-hmm. you could possibly find it. But on the backup spot, there's also going to be a couple of other birds that you're going to be looking for. So let's use an example, kingfisher, mm-hmm. a belted kingfisher. So that can be a hard bird. They nest in burrows, so they can be a hard bird that time of the year to find, because if they're not out over water hunting for fish, mm-hmm. You're not going to get them. And so how long do you spend at a potential spot, a gravel pit or something for a belted kingfisher? Mm-hmm. You're going to give it 3 minutes? You're going to give it 5 minutes? Because every minute you take cuts into the other possibilities that mm-hmm. you're going to get. So there's a lot of strategy that goes into it. Mm-hmm. And that's the fun part. To be quite honest with you, that is the absolute most fun part of birding is the strategy of a big day.
Mm-hmm. And is that when you say the strategy, is that all stuff you do in preparation, like beforehand, or can you?
Yeah, kind of it's the preparation, but it's also like you say the where are we going to get this bird? Where's the backup spot? And mm-hmm. on the backup spot, what other birds could we get? Mm-hmm. So if we're over a pond where there's likely to be a kingfisher because there's a gravel pit a possible nesting spot nearby. What else are we going to get on that pond? Are we going to get a bittern, an American bittern, or maybe a couple of late ducks, whatever? Mm-hmm. So that's the fun part, is sitting down with every species that you hope to get and figuring out the best spot for them and a backup spot, and what else could you get at that backup spot. So
it's a wish list.
It's a wish list.
Do you ever play like a version of bingo with that? You know, you could do that. You could make that into like a bingo chart. And
yeah. Well, there's actually there's a bird guy, a bird game called birding, and it's a fun game actually. And I have it. A good friend of mine, Dan Shustak, who bans birds, juncos at my house. Mm-hmm. Gave it to me, so it's a really fun game.
Yeah. So, for someone just starting out, what would you recommend?
Once again, be as familiar as you can with habitat. Mm-hmm. So, example, I take the Canyon Ranch Birding Group to Parsons Marsh or Canoe Meadows. Mm-hmm. There's a variety of habitats. Parsons Marsh is a Berkshire Natural Resources Council property. It's beautiful. There's a long boardwalk, so it's a handicap accessible boardwalk. And it goes out to a wetland where there's a platform that looks out over the marsh. So you can see water birds there. And on the way on the boardwalk, you're going through deciduous woods. And so there's wetland birds, there's forest birds, there's edge birds. Mm-hmm. These are all habitats that if you are familiar with them, they're all there. And Canoe Meadows is the same. It's a Mass Audubon property in Pittsfield with well-marked trails and great habitat.
Yeah, and like you said, a variety of habitats.
A variety of habitats.
A lot of wetland, but also you got the woodland and stuff like that.
Yeah, so variety. Neat. If you're looking to get as many species of birds as you can, the variety of habitats is going to give you the best chance, clearly.
But still do your research in advance, get your guide out, kind of figure out what birds are going to be around at whatever time you're going to set out, and make your list, right? And then do some studying, do your research, try to figure out where their habitats are, so when you go out there, you're a little more successful.
This is all planning so important. Mm-hmm. But there's also a whole other feature of birding, which is just the fun of it. Mm-hmm. And I'll relate to a simple experiment that was done back in the 50s by a fellow by the name of J.P. Skinner, who was actually a psychiatrist. And what he did was condition mice to press a lever to get a reward. Sometimes the reward was a big reward, sometimes it was nothing. Mm-hmm. But he found that if he gave a small reward every time the mouse pressed a lever, they were much less inclined to be addicted to pressing that lever. It was the big reward that addicted them. So this is like birding. You can go out and you can spend, I can't tell you how many hours I have looked out over the ocean and seen nothing but water. But every once in a while, you get something good, a gannet or a dovekie or an alcid. And that's what makes it addictive.
Yeah.
It's that one bird that you're going to get that's the big reward.
Right, right.
So
it's worth it. That's the investment pays off for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But birding is also, I'll digress a little bit here and just say it's great for older folks especially. It gives you your walking. Mm-hmm. Your memory is increased because you're trying to remember field marks. Mm. Your sight and hearing are improved because you're tuning in to bird song, which I'll talk about in just a minute.
Yeah. So we're approaching the top of the hour, so we do have to take a quick station break. This is WTBR. This is the Morning Drive, and our guest this morning is Ed Newmuth, who is a active birder and has led a number of bird guiding hikes here in Berkshire County. So he's got a wealth of knowledge about migrations and what to look for when you, if you're interested in getting into birding, or for those of you who are already heavily involved with this. So we'll be back in just a moment. Again, it's WTBR.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Another hour of powerhouse hits.
We will rock you
from the station that rocks. 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs. Greylock Federal, opportunity grows here. With locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org. And from Evco Hypnosis. Want to lose weight, quit smoking, sleep better, or relieve stress and anxiety? Evco Hypnosis is here to help you become happier, healthier, and stronger. Call 413-212-0283 or go to evcohypnosis.com. That's EVCOhypnosis.com.
We all know WTBR is great to listen to on 89.7 FM, but did you know that you can listen to WTBR just about anywhere? We've got a web stream, and it's easy to use. Go to WTBRFM.com on your computer and click play. You can use the TuneIn app on your smartphone and connect it to your car's sound system. Or you can use your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play WTBRFM, and there's your community radio station. WTBR, for the love of radio.
Are you struggling with your pet? Berkshire Humane Society is here to help. We have a pet food pantry, low-cost cat spay and neuters, free pet care advice, and if you're in the hospital or in crisis, temporary foster care. If you need to give up your pet, we'll accept your animal with kindness and find them the best new home possible. Please call Berkshire Humane Society at 413-447-7878.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Hola, hola. I'm Daisy.
Yo soy Marta.
Whether you want to learn a little Spanish or get a glimpse of our wonderful Latin roots, join us as we celebrate Latin culture with music from genres ranging from salsa to bachata. Gain insight on local news, community information, and very special guests. Only on Mundo Latino, welcoming listeners of all nations on WTBR 89.7 FM.
Support for Mundo Latino comes from community health programs. Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. BCC provides access to higher education to everyone in Berkshire County and beyond, offering more than 50 high-quality programs, small class sizes, and an affordable education to help their students of all ages achieve their dreams. At BCC, their middle name is community. And from Tim's Lawn Care, it's almost time for spring cleanups. Tim's Lawn Care can also take care of your landscaping, lawn care, mulching, and more. Tim's Lawn Care, 413-281-4222 and online at timslawncarelandscaping.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, so welcome back to WTBR's Morning Drive. We're at 89.7 FM. We are live and local at the studio here on Federico Drive here in Pittsfield. Our guest today is Ed Newmuth, who is an active birder and has led a number of groups on birding guides here in Berkshire County. He's been an active birder for about 50 years, has a lot of good insight, a lot of knowledge about the birding world. And before we get back into that conversation, we're just going to check in with our weather and see what's in store for us in the next couple of days.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, showers this morning, then a chance of showers and drizzle this afternoon. Cooler. Near steady temperature in the mid-40s. East wind 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour. Chance of rain 90%. Tonight, a chance of showers in the evening. Mostly cloudy with a chance of drizzle. Lows around 40. East wind 5 to 10 miles per hour. Chance of rain 30%. Friday, mostly cloudy. Highs in the upper 50s. Southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts up to 30 miles per hour in the afternoon. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, sounds reasonable for April. Hopefully the weekend's going to be a little nicer. I know a lot of people have a lot of projects to do this time of year, myself included. Ed, I know you do as well. So anyway, we were talking about birding, and we talked a lot about the migration aspect of things, and you wanted to get into some of the nesting.
Right.
Portions of
which I feel is why the Berkshires are so special.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, I'll just remind people that we have a lot of different habitats here, and during the nesting season, habitat is incredibly important because you'll rarely find a swamp bird or a grassland bird in the forest during the nesting season. During migration, that's a possibility, but mm-hmm. not during the nesting season. So I like to use the example of it's a Friday night. You just got paid. You're out to find a young woman. I'm a guy, by the way. So you're out to find a young woman with similar interests. So are you going to go to a bowling alley, a Tanglewood, or a sports bar, or where are you going to go that you're going to meet someone of similar interest? So an example is like a swamp sparrow will find a swamp, a wetland, sing wildly, and eventually a female will be flying by and hear that song and drop down.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not going to concentrate on a forest. She's going to always go to the habitat that she prefers to nest in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, let's talk just briefly about what a year in a bird's life might be like.
Yeah, sure.
So why is nesting in the Berkshires so valuable? Because we have the habitats, we have the elevation. So there was a fellow back in the 1800s by the name of Alexander Humboldt who postulated that if you move from the equator north,
mm-hmm.
it's equivalent to moving up in elevation on a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, it's, I can give you the details, but it's not that important. But we have Greylock.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have birds that nest on Mount Greylock that nest nowhere else in the state.
Right, it makes another uniqueness about
the black pole warbler.
Yeah.
If you want to find a black pole, you go to the summit of Mount Greylock,
mm-hmm.
and you walk around until you hopefully hear one, you know, or see one. So, I also mentioned that bird song is so important,
mm-hmm.
and that there's and territory. So, why do birds sing? They sing to define their territory, and they sing to attract a mate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great Far Side cartoon that I'll share with you. I'm a Far Side fan. It's a picture of a fellow and his son out in the suburban neighborhood. Every house has a fence around it, and there's a bird singing up in the tree, and the father's postulating to his son or pontificating. That bird is singing because he's marking his territory, something we see commonly in these lower forms of life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every yard has a fence around it.
Right.
So territory is incredibly important. That's one of the reasons why birds sing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they establish their territory, and they sing for a mate.
Mm-hmm.
So bird song is most active in the early morning.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you get up tomorrow morning and you listen outside at dawn, the first bird you'll hear is probably a robin singing.
Mm-hmm.
And bird song diminishes by about 30% every hour after dawn.
30% per hour?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you really want to learn bird songs, you've got to be an early riser and get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And bird song, I mean, it's not that hard. There are so many helpful measures these days.
Yeah, like the apps. There's apps and so forth you can use even to.
So I'll mention the Merlin app from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Mm-hmm.
If you download it for free, and you can, You can use Merlin to identify sound ID. It's like Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
A bird song will occur. You'll hold the app up if you hit sound ID. And most of the time, and I shouldn't say this, but every once in a while, Merlin is not on track. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it will give you the identification of the bird.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a... But the important thing is don't rely on that. Learn the bird songs so that you don't need Merlin.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ticket.
Right, which is your case, because I, like I said, the many times that we've been walking together and you're just, yeah, everybody, people are chit-chatting, and all of a sudden you're just like, oh, that's this and that's that. And we're all like, how did you even notice that?
Well,
but you're so in tune to it.
Yeah, you tune
you've got
into
such an ear
it.
For it, right?
Yeah, and it does require some exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember one of the OLLI programs I had that I was leading a group of people out in the field, and I was looking for a critique at the end of the period. And one of the women said, you know, you've just ruined my gardening, because when I'm out gardening, which I love to do, mm-hmm. and I hear a bird song that I can't identify, I leave the garden and pick up my binoculars and try to find it.
Uh-huh.
So it's being aware
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and of bird song.
Mm-hmm.
And you can individualize them. It's a lot of fun.
So what was interesting, too, was when you were talking about how there's that period of time in the morning with the diminished light and so forth where you hear the most bird song. What was interesting was last week with the eclipse, how I don't know if you had a chance to be outside when that happened, but how the birds all sort of retreated, you know, at that time, even from flying around. And then I started to hear them chirping again, like it was morning time as the sun started to come back.
Yeah, it was dark.
Yeah, it was a little, they kind of fell for it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting.
It was a tricky thing.
Yeah.
So a year in the life of a bird. Let me just kind of give you this is the generic bird that doesn't really occur, but... So it's a neotropical migrant. So come around the daylight change that this bird gets the Zugunru to mm-hmm. move north
mm-hmm.
With the daylight change, etc. They will molt into their, again, the generic bird, into their breeding plumage, which is also referred to as their alternate plumage.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't hold that plumage all year. They hold it only for the breeding season. So these are the colorful males, let's say the warblers, that are absolutely beautiful. I mean, they're stunning. This mm-hmm. is why people love warblers.
Mm-hmm.
So that bird then starts to migrate. So why is the male so brightly colored and the female less mm-hmm. brightly colored? Because probably she's the one who incubates the eggs and doesn't mm. really want those bright colors to attract a predator while she's on the nest.
Right, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense, yeah.
So he arrives or in his migration, finds the habitat that he is suitable for, that he knows a mate who's going to also frequent, and sets up his... territory
mm-hmm.
and starts singing to define his territory and, excuse me, hopefully attract a mate.
Mm-hmm.
So then at the end of the nesting season, he'll molt, and he'll molt into his basic plumage or his non-breeding plumage, which is much duller.
Mm-hmm.
This is why birds in the spring, this is the time to be out birding. The birds are vocal. They're brightly colored for the most part, and they're easier to identify. Mm. In the fall, they're in their basic plumage, which is their non-breeding plumage
mm-hmm.
that they wear through the winter mm. in the habitat that they winter over in. They're not vocal
mm-hmm.
because they don't really need to define their territory and attract a mate.
Right.
A lot harder to bird in the fall.
Yeah. Not as visible, not as vocal. So that's why they're springtime, because all the activity that's going on in their life cycle helps them to really stand out much, much more.
Yeah,
it's a lot easier to identify them that way.
The page of warblers, for instance, in Peterson's field guide will say excuse me, mm-hmm. confusing fall warblers mm-hmm. because they are confusing. They mm-hmm. look entirely different yeah. in their basic or non-breeding plumage than they do in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge. Fall birding is a challenge, but it's also rewarding because there's actually more birds, and this is the chance that you'll get to see those migrants that are moving through from nesting in Canada through the Berkshires to their wintering ground, the Tennessee warbler, the bay-breasted warbler, mm-hmm. the Cape May warbler.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get a chance to see them, but they're tricky.
Yeah.
They're not singing, so that's a clue to identification, obviously, and they're dull,
mm-hmm.
so mm-hmm. you really have to be on it yeah. to get them.
So anybody just joining us, I want to let you know that you're listening to WTBR, The Morning Show, The Morning Drive, 89.7, and our guest today is Ed Newmyth. Ed is here talking about birding here in the Berkshires. He's got a lot of experience with it. He's led a number of groups and organizations on hikes throughout the Berkshires at the peak seasons and throughout the year. Very knowledgeable on this subject, so glad to have that conversation because we're getting into the busy season here. And Ed, you mentioned before the show to me something about Mass Audubon has a birdathon.
Yes.
Can you talk on that a little bit?
Sure. That's a fundraiser mm-hmm. for Mass Audubon. And what it basically is a 24-hour period because most of the population in Massachusetts is on the eastern part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually earlier than the big day for the Berkshires would be. By about a week.
Right.
But it's teams from different sanctuaries in Mass Audubon sanctuaries that go out in the field and try from 6 o'clock Friday night till 6 o'clock the following Saturday. I think it's the 10th and 11th of May this year
mm-hmm.
To see as many species as they can. And people pledge, you know, like a nickel a species for the winning team or mm-hmm. whatever. And you can raise money for Mass Audubon. It's a great fundraiser. And it's a great experience
yeah.
to, once again, get out in the field and bird your brains out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all good.
And this would be through the Mass Audubon, assuming that they probably have a link to that on their website.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that. You don't have to do it on an Audubon property? Can you do
don't
it
have to do it okay. on an Audubon property. In fact, the team that comes out to do it from Moose Hill Sanctuary in Sharon, Mass,
yep.
Come out to the Berkshires. So most teams, sanctuaries will field a team of number of different teams that mm-hmm. cover different areas of the state because, like I say, we have such a great spot out here. Anybody who's doing the birdathon and does not cover the Berkshires with a team is going to miss out yep. completely.
What's the date on that again?
I think it's May 10th.
Okay.
It's a Friday and the following Saturday, 6 o'clock Friday night till 6 o'clock Saturday. But it's earlier than I would choose to do a big day here in the Berkshires
mm-hmm.
because coastal migrants occur a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and it's the same thing with everything when it comes to east and west here in Massachusetts. I mean, we always see the trees and everything bloom sooner out in Boston, even Springfield, right?
Totally.
And the same with in the autumn, the same thing with the changing of the colors. There's always a big difference just an hour away makes a big difference. So I would assume that applies as well, just like you said, to all things nature, and that
yeah.
includes the birds
yep.
and the avian. Yep. When you talk about migrating birds, I know people always talk about robins being a sign of spring, but they're here all year. Is that right?
They are here all year.
Okay.
And so, I don't want to get into climate change, but things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing some of the migrants arriving earlier
mm-hmm.
and some of them nesting far north of where they normally would nest.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a post-glacial warming trend
mm-hmm.
that's accelerated by human activity.
Yeah.
That's basically the way it goes. So why is birding so fun? It's fun because it's fun.
Yeah. Well, you're outside.
You're exercising. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you're increasing your memory. And so one of the tips that I would say if you're a beginning birder is to try to create in your mind an individual. So let's use an example of a white-throated sparrow. Mm-hmm. White-throated sparrow is a bird that nests in the Berkshires. A few of them will overwinter here, but if you create an individual, so you learn as much as you can about a white-throated sparrow, you learn what its song sounds like, you learn if it's a migrant, what's the arrival date, mm-hmm. what's the departure date, you create an individual. So I use the example, the phone rings, you pick it up, and somebody says, hey, how you doing? You recognize their voice. You recognize, mm-hmm. you know that they have, they're married or not, they have kids, what kind of car they drive. All the information that you can accumulate about them creates an individual, mm-hmm. which is the same kind of thing that you want to do with birds. Mm-hmm. You want to get as much information about a species as you possibly can, so that species becomes an identity. And at the end of the day, you've been out birding with a group, and everybody, the beginning birders, want to write down as soon as they hear a bird or see a bird, what, you know, we'll forget it. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we aren't going to forget it. It's like if you go to the mall mm-hmm. in the old days and you ran into 10 different friends, you could remember when you got home mm-hmm. who they were. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So similarly, if you create an individual out of these birds, it's a lot easier to remember.
Right. So I've got one question for you as far as birds and identifying. Big bird. What kind of bird is Big Bird? If you had to guess.
So I used to have a bumper sticker. Yeah. I break for birds, and it was a picture of Big Bird. You know?
Yeah. So what's your best guess, if you had to guess?
Oh, God. Let's see. Big Bird, that's a tough one.
He's just a unique individual,
that's
right?
That's not in the field guides.
Yeah. And so, he's not much of a migrator either, because he's always there all year round on Sesame Street.
So
right?
So what makes birds so fascinating mm-hmm. is that the largest bird currently is the ostrich, mm-hmm. and the smallest bird is a bee hummingbird, which mm-hmm. could actually fit comfortably on the toenail of an ostrich.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I mean, they're tiny. Yeah. So this variety is what makes birding so interesting. Yeah. It's also humbling. Yeah. It's humbling because you know in your heart that these birds are doing what they're doing mm-hmm. and have been doing it for thousands and thousands of years without any human influence. Mm-hmm. So we aren't really essentially a part of their life.
Right.
And so you can step aside when you go out into the field and go birding. You can do it intensely enough that if you have an intense job, mm-hmm. like I was a veterinarian, and one of the ways that I could relax was to go out and substitute birding for my cases. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was able to...
That was your decompression.
That was my decompression, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. So.
And that, like you said, that was what worked for you. But I mean, that can be for so many people because anybody. Of all the other elements that are involved there. You're out in nature,
and also the thing is, Brian, you're out in nature, and all of a sudden you see a wildflower that you can't identify, mm-hmm. and you're curious about it, mm-hmm. and so you see a mammal, like a mink, mm-hmm. carrying young mm-hmm. from one place to another.
So, being out there birding, if that's your mission, but it opens you up to everything else that's going on in that environment that you might not
otherwise
see.
It's the avenue that takes you into the natural world.
Right, right. And I think we need as many opportunities for that as possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just to really, really appreciate what's around us. And we're so fortunate here in the Berkshires to have so many locations to go to. You know, I mean... There's all these protected lands that we have here.
Absolutely.
With the Audubon Society and the Berkshire Natural Resource and the trustees.
Trustees and Nature Conservancy. Mm-hmm. So we have
And this is a state forest as well. I mean, there's just so many things.
Yeah. We have terrific habitat and lots of it. So there's no reason in the world why people can't get out there within a half an hour of their home and be in a wild place.
Mm-hmm. Is there any place, I know like you mentioned, you've led some hikes for the trustees and Audubon. And I know that, you know, Audubon has different programming. And then, you know, Ollie, you've done some training with Ollie. What would you recommend to somebody who's looking to get into birding and wants to really kind of expound, other than, you know, doing their own research in the journals, but looking to kind of connect with somebody who's more experienced?
All right,
what would you recommend?
Good question. I would say look up the Hoffman Bird Club, which is the local bird club that meets at Guardian Life. And the meetings are free. The field trips are free. Mm. And if you are on and the field trips are right now abundant because this is the best time to be out birding. But the field trips are free. Google Hoffman Bird Club. You'll get their website. The field trips, the list of all the people leading the field trips, where you can meet, contact the leader, and the best advice I could say is if you're a beginning birder and you go on a Hoffman Bird Club field trip, go up to the leader and say, you know, I'm a beginning birder. Mm-hmm. I'd like to kind of pal up with somebody who can show me. And the bird club takes people to different habitats. So, you know, so for instance, we have one coming up on Sunday led by Chuck and Carrie Chuck
with the Hoffman
Bird Club. Mm-hmm. It's up in Williamstown, so we'll see a little bit of North County. We'll go to a couple of places that the leader has chosen to take folks. It'll familiarize you with some of the different spots that you can go to in the county. So almost all of our Hoffman Bird Club trips are within Berkshire County.
So the Hoffman Bird Club, is that a nonprofit or is it?
Boy, you got me.
Okay.
it's a nonprofit, but one of the things I'll plug is that we, if the meetings are free and the field trips are free, why do you even want to join with a membership fee? Well, you can learn the secret handshake. So we also have a Maryland floor campership, and this is something that's kind of, I'm proud of it. Maryland Floor was a naturalist at the Pleasant Valley Sanctuary in Lenox, and when she moved out of the area, we started a Maryland Floor campership, which means that it's a separate fund that we raise money to send disadvantaged kids to summer camp at Pleasant Valley.
Oh, great! Yeah,
yeah, and the fund is building up. So sometimes we'll send as many as four or five children who are disadvantaged financially to go to the camp to experience nature.
Yeah, and they have a great camp. I actually went to camp there when I was a kid.
Did you?
Yeah, to Audubon. Yeah, I remember all the lectures on birds and bats and beavers and everything else, all the other bees.
Yeah, it's all fun.
Yeah, it's a great place. That's fantastic that you guys are able to coordinate that for kids who might not otherwise have an opportunity to get down there and
Learn
some of this stuff. So we've got a little less than a minute left. Is there anything, any wise words on the way out here?
I think if you like warblers, let me just say that this is the season from now, probably until maybe the end of June, that you can see as many as 20 species of warblers that nest in the Berkshires. This is unparalleled, you know?
Well, Ed Newmuth, thank you for being here. Thanks for sharing
all your knowledge, Brian. Yeah, for having me.
Yeah, it's great conversation, and you know, obviously we're getting into that time of year. So I appreciate you being here today to talk with us, and hopefully we'll have you back sometime, and happy birding.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, thank you.